Very interesting. Should we just ask maybe for consider the audience that is less experienced than you about the side effects and what to expect? Is there anything you would like to advise in terms of, for example, GI side effects, or you just mentioned hypoglycemia? Is there anything you would like to advise the investigators?
Well, GLP-1 is an intestinal hormone. The natural peptide has a very short half-life. The homology or the pharmacokinetic profile has been changed with semaglutide, so it has a longer half-life. You can either take it as a tablet or an injection. What we know is that the side effects are dose-dependent. So the more GLP-1 or the more semaglutide on board, the higher the risk of side effects. They are primarily in the gastrointestinal tract. They are dose-dependent. So little GLP-1, little risk of gastrointestinal side effects. And here I'm talking about nausea, diarrhea. Higher doses give some level of constipation. Overall, in short, they're mild to moderate and very often transient. It's like 10% to 15% of the patients who get side effects. When I prescribe GLP-1 in type 2 diabetes or obesity, I tell them about the potential of or the risk of having side effects, but I usually say that 85% or 90% do not get side effects. And I think that's very important, especially when we talk about body weight decrease and obesity. Some patients believe that they need side effects to have the effect. And what we have learned in diabetes and obesity is that you have very close to the similar effects, independently of whether you have side effects or not. In real life, compared to the trials, if patients have side effects, we titrate them slower, and we keep them on the maximal tolerated dose. Patients who have diabetes or obesity, they can tolerate a lot if they know what the effects are, and I would imagine exactly the same in patients with Alzheimer's disease. They just need to know from the beginning that it might occur, but usually I say after a couple of months, then it is gone in the vast majority of the patients.
I think it's probably also important to explain about the effects on satiety and hunger so that patients would expect to actually feel less hungry and more satiated, so they shouldn't be concerned that they might, and especially maybe even a little bit more in the beginning also, that they feel less desire to eat, to be aware that that is an expected pharmacology from GLP-1.
I think it's worthwhile noticing that these effects that we are talking about, the nausea and the vomiting, they are not gastrointestinal. They're elicited from the brain. So perhaps in particular from the area postrema. So this is one of the CNS actions of GLP-1. So this must be seen in when we're talking about CNS actions. So this is one of them.
Yeah, very interesting. So body weight, is that like a concern for people with Alzheimer's? Body weight loss, of course.
I would say not in general, at least. I mean, obviously, there are some patients for those this might be of interest, but this is not a general topic.
Can I ask, blood pressure? Does that matter?
Blood pressure is more important.
Yeah, is it?
Yeah.
So again, it's interesting because here we have something that has a definite beneficial action on blood pressure. And improvement of circulation. Again, we come back to circulation, I think.
But I would imagine since overweight and obesity are becoming more and more prevalent in the background population, I mean, more than half of the population worldwide are overweight. So I would imagine that even in type 1 diabetes, patients are overweight. So unless Alzheimer's disease, probably late in the disease, they might be difficult to keep weight on. I would imagine that in average, they might also benefit from losing a little bit, but that's just my general impression.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
I think there was the one question you wanted to ask Lotte.
Yeah, there is the general question. Now we are doing two very important and interesting clinical trials in Alzheimer's disease, But the question is, for potential future indications for semaglutide in other neurological disorders, might you speculate on this?
Yeah, so I can actually say a little bit more than speculation, because there are two nice clinical papers published on GLP-1 and Parkinson's disease, and there's also quite a lot of science around neuroinflammation, I think, in Parkinson's disease. So I think that's an obvious one to say that there actually could be an effect there. Via some of the same mechanisms, and then I guess we could also start to think about, okay, so if we can prove this effect on neuroinflammation in patients, are there then other diseases where neuroinflammation is important that we could then also think about GLP-1? So one thing that I heard about a couple of years ago is this intracranial hypertension, which I thought was, which is rising with young, especially young women, very obese women have this intracranial hypertension. There's a group in Copenhagen and a group in London that has been studying that. And there are animal studies that show that it's actually quite beneficial with GLP-1, and I think we'll see maybe clinical studies coming also. And then also this story is a little bit funny, right? Because it actually caught NASA's attention, because apparently when astronauts have to go to deeper space, then they get intracranial hypertension. So I think NASA might actually be treating their astronauts with GLP-1 on space missions, right? I have no idea. It's just that you can actually Google that NASA has interested in GLP-1 because of that effect. But I think also I'm obviously not a neurologist. I'm not even a medical doctor. But can I also ask you what other neurological diseases, is neuroinflammation important? Are there anything that comes to your mind?
I think that especially frontotemporal dementia would be one where I would be very interested to learn more about this, because this is such an important neurodegenerative disease, and we do not have anything that we can do against this disease. We have tested anti-tau strategies several years ago without any success. So there are obviously several more neurodegenerative diseases where we are waiting for an interesting compound to be tested.
Mm-hmm. What about patients with multi-infarction dementia? I mean, talking about the cardiovascular component, wouldn't that be interesting as well?
Yes, sure. As I'm a psychiatrist, I'm not so familiar with kind of patients. This is more something that patients that are treated in the neurology department. But I can imagine that this would be also of interest.
And there's also experimental support for that,
And multiple sclerosis, of course. Neuroinflammation is very important there, but it is super difficult to build up the evidence actually for new indications. So I think we need the data from Alzheimer's disease and then see where we go with that.
Yeah, and this is probably the point where we can sum up that we have learned today, really, that there is huge evidence, especially from basic research, but also from clinical research, that this approach is of interest. And we are now very curious about the results of the ongoing phase 3 trials. And I would like to thank everybody here in this round for discussing today this interesting topic. And with this, I would like to conclude our discussion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.